You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO, at 102.7 FM.
Advertising aims to make us dissatisfied with what we have, to discard the old, and to purchase new products to replace them. In our dizzying world of continuous consumption, we unconsciously often discard history as also worthless. The present swallows everything. In June 1935, 1,000 young men jumped on railroad boxcars in Vancouver and headed for Ottawa. And so began the On to Ottawa trek. What was it about? And is it relevant today? Joey Hartman, a trade union activist for the past 30 years and a member of the Pacific Northwest Labor History Association, has joined me in the studio to explore just these questions. Welcome to Red Eye, Joey.
Thanks very much, Mordecai.
The trek began in the midst of the last Great Depression. What were the conditions for working people in BC at that time?
Well, the conditions were extremely harsh, and in fact, I wouldn't say working people, I would say non-working people, because as much as they tried, they really couldn't get any income. By 1932, the government had responded to the fact that there was thousands and thousands of young men tramping the country and the whole continent looking for itinerant work, a little bit of agricultural work or whatever they could pick up for just cents. And so many of them were in very, very bad shape by 1932, when the government was worried about the increase of radicalism because of their condition. These young men knew it wasn't of their making that they were starving and looking for work. And so the government responded federally by setting up what was called relief camps across the country. The men in them called them slave camps.
What kind of things did they do in those camps?
They were paid 20 cents a day to do work projects. And so one of the criteria to be allowed into the camp was being physically fit, and I actually think that was one of the highest criteria. They did things like build roads, bridges, buildings, but sometimes it was as menial as moving rock piles from one place to another, just to keep them engaged and physically engaged.
And what were their camp conditions like and their food conditions?
They were in very isolated places. So think about the Japanese internment camps and how they deliberately put these folks away from urban environments. They were in tar paper shacks with bunks close enough that they say they could touch the fellow on each side and the fellow above them just by reaching out their arms.
And did this sort of still the radicalism? Did this sort of leave them isolated and disorganized?
No, it had the opposite effect, as you can imagine. It wasn't long before the Workers' Unity League, which was a communist organization, organized the Relief Camp Workers' Union. And so by 1935, under the leadership of Arthur Evans, who was known as Slim Evans, they had a list of demands, and it included things like having health and safety, a first aid kit, because imagine with this work that they were doing, people got injured, and there wasn't any hospital around the corner. They also wanted the right to vote, and they wanted repeal of a section of the labor code that was used against people who were vagrants. If they spoke out against government, they could be jailed for up to 20 years or deported. So it was those kinds of things that they were seeking.
And they were in those camps, so did they, that's leaving them still quite isolated, mm-hmm. Did they come into Vancouver or what?
They did. Their strike began in the beginning of 1935, and they were hoping that the federal government would pay attention to their demands. They wanted work and wages, was their primary demand, actually. And when the government ignored them, by April, they left the camps, and 1,600 men by around April 4th had converged upon Vancouver.
And in Vancouver, were they kind of just on their own? Was there solidarity with them?
Absolutely, there was solidarity. They organized parades, tag days, and tin canning days to raise money. And if somebody donated money into their tin can, they got a little tag put on their collar, which indicated that they'd made a donation. And as poor as people in Vancouver were at that time, because they also were experiencing the depths of the Depression, the people were very proud to donate. And there was also a huge May Day event, and there was a huge Mother's Day event in Stanley Park, where the mothers were calling for the abolishment of the relief camps and to support these young men. The Vancouver citizens all knew a boy like this or a young man like this, if not one of their own family. The government of the city, however, was not so supportive.
And the government was headed by whom?
Jerry McGeer was the mayor at the time.
Is he the father of Pat McGeer, who was later in the...
I think he's the uncle.
Uncle, okay.
Yes.
So what did the mayor do in response to... You now have these large numbers of young people. You have mobilization in the city of support. Mm-hmm. What stand did he take? What actions did he take?
Well, they'd been holding almost daily public events, often at Victory Square at Canby and Hastings, became known as the place to go and get information and daily updates, as well as the Powell Street grounds, which are now Oppenheimer Park. So the mayor used the excuse there had been a scuffle in a department store and some shelves, glass shelves, had been broken. So they used the excuse to read the Riot Act and say that they were dispersing or that they would all be imprisoned as vagrants.
And reading the Riot Act is followed by what, a police riot?
Not yet. The reading of the Riot Act made the trekkers, who were not yet trekkers, they were relief camp strikers at this point, decide that they really needed to take their story to Ottawa and their demands to Ottawa, because they recognized that while they had been protesting at a civic level in Vancouver, the issues that they were calling to have addressed were national. And so the call went up onto Ottawa, and they made the decision to en masse go to Ottawa with their issues.
Going to Ottawa, how?
On the top of the CPR trains, which is an amazing... This is the drama of the story, is that on the evening of June 3rd, 1935, 1,200 of these young men climbed atop the boxcars on the CPR lines, and it's basically the railway lines that you see when you go across the overpass at the foot of Main Street that connects to Crab Park.
And now you're heading to Ottawa. That's mountain country, going mm-hmm. through the Rockies, tunnels, and they're riding on the tops of the boxcars.
So you can imagine how, you know, terribly exposed to the elements and how cold and windy and with the steam and the soot and the coal and all of that that would be coming back into their faces. But that's absolutely what they intended to do. And the CPR was cooperating because, of course, the city wanted rid of them. And the federal government thought there's no way that they're going to be able to make their, you know, keep this going past the Rockies, because they too knew how the exposure and, you know, the tunnel that you mentioned, I think, was 7 miles long, and it was apparently airless and claustrophobic and very little, you know, they all had to pull their heads down to make sure that they weren't knocked off. Terrible.
And what reception did the trekkers get when the train went through its various stops on route in towns between here and...
Well, two main things, I would say. One is that at every stop, more people joined on. They saw that this was an important event and something that they wanted to be part of. And the other thing that happened was that the townships rallied around and prepared for the trekkers on the stop. And Golden, in particular, is a place that stood out in these fellows' memories for life, because when the trains rolled into Golden, they were met with the community was there, and the women, particularly of the community, had prepared cast iron bathtubs full of bubbling stew on open fires. And you can just imagine how that warmed people's hearts, but it also filled their bellies and kept them going for the next part of the trek.
So the train got as far as Regina. Mm-hmm. Who stopped it there?
The federal government was getting very nervous, because here was this event that they thought would just be over in a couple of days. But by the time they got to Regina, there was over 2,000 people on the trek and another 1,000 waiting in Winnipeg to join on. And the result was that the R.B. Bennett, Iron Heel Bennett, as the Prime Minister, ordered the RCMP to stop the eastbound trains in Regina. They accepted that they would have a delegation of 8 continue on to Ottawa for a meeting with the Prime Minister.
That meeting?
Went very badly. The Prime Minister rejected all of their demands outright. The Prime Minister also called the leader, Slim Evans, a thief, because he had sent some money to a U.S. group of miners who were starving, and the Prime Minister claimed that that had not been properly authorized. The response by Slim Evans was that the Prime Minister was a liar, and it kind of disintegrated from there.
And in Regina, there was the police riot.
Mm-hmm. So the eight leaders of the Trek, after their meeting with R.B. Bennett, were returned to Regina. They say it's on the cushions, which means that that portion of the trip was inside the train, on a passenger train. They returned to Regina, and on Dominion Day, July 1st, in Market Square, they were having a public meeting with the leaders present. And mostly it was community people from Regina who were there. So of 3,000 attendees at this public meeting, only 300 of them were Trekkers, because the others were off at a baseball game somewhere else. And a whistle, they say this memory is that a shrill whistle blew, and moving vans threw open the doors, and out came the police. And the first thing they did was to try and arrest the leaders of the Trek, which quickly deteriorated into swinging clubs at people, shooting. It was a police riot, and it was invoked by the RCMP.
Was the Trek a failure then, having been stopped at Regina?
Not at all. The memory of the Trek, for those of people like myself, the spirit of the Trek has sustained generations of trade unionists and social activists since then. But more immediately, in 1935, while the Trek itself had been crushed, the knowledge of it and the treatment of the conservative federal government against its people was really had horrified Canadian citizens. So R.B. Bennett's government was up for re-election about 3 months after the Trek was crushed, and they were completely trounced. The Mackenzie King government came in, and I'm not sure that as liberals they really wanted to do this, but what they were felt compelled to do under pressure was to close the relief camps, to introduce the first forms of unemployment insurance in Canada, and to repeal the part of the Criminal Act that was so offensive to the Trekkers, as well as some other social reforms that we continue to enjoy today.
What relevance do you see of this historic event, and it has its inspiring quality for mm-hmm. sure, with the contemporary situation, both of organizing among working people, unemployed people, young people?
Well, I think that in the decades after the Trek, there was a lot of improvements, clearly. You know, we did have more and more people working, the economy was better, and there was a lot of social reforms. But in recent years, it's really been going much backwards. And the level of homelessness and poverty, particularly in a city like Vancouver, is pretty horrifying and very much in keeping with the conditions that gave rise to the events of 1935, when the folks who were suffering basically said no more. And I think that's absolutely relevant to contemporary issues.
You've got an event tomorrow commemorating the 75 years since the Trekkers took the boxcars onto Ottawa. Tell us about that event.
The event is being held at Crab Park on Sunday, June 6th, so tomorrow. We are hoping that a lot of people come, but we also hope most of them will take the transit because there's very limited parking. And there's going to be, if people come a little early at 12:30, Carnival Band will be playing. But the focus is around the unveiling of a bronze plaque, which will be a permanent fixture on the overpass that, as I mentioned earlier, connects Crab Park with Main Street on the north end. And so that plaque will be in a position where right over the very beginning of the track on the railway tracks, people can read about it for, we hope, decades to come. We've got a proclamation that will be read from the mayor of Vancouver to dedicate this as the Onto Ottawa Day, and the deputy mayor will be reading that. We have Libby Davies and Jim Sinclair will be speaking. And Om Johal and other people who are going to be leaving tomorrow night from the railway station are going to be taking a 2010 trek to Ottawa to raise awareness and lobby politicians in Ottawa of all four parties to try and get something in the way of a national housing strategy. We used to have federal funding for housing. It's long gone, and it's desperately needed again.
Well, thank you very much for coming in today and telling us this, the account of the trek and its relevance and the activities tomorrow. Thanks, Joey.
Great. Can I just give you our website, because most of this information is there, as well as some videos and historic photographs. The website is www.ontoottawa.ca. Thanks so much for the opportunity.
You're most welcome. I've been speaking with Joey Hartman. She's a trade union activist for the past 30 years. She's a member of the Pacific Northwest Labor History Association, and she's active in the Onto Ottawa Trek Historical Society. As Joey said, their address is ontoottawa.ca.